Okay, are we ready to begin? Everybody's here except for Michelle, which I just heard she'll be a little late this morning.
Thank you.
I guess I'll call it to order because we haven't voted on a chair yet, but that's going to be our next thing to do. But since we have a newbie, let's go ahead and move on to the next one.
Sure. Kevin Lawson.
Amanda Fells.
Alex Hopper.
Greg Beat.
Sherry McPherson.
Shelley Houston.
Julie Nadeau.
Kimberly Fast.
Scott Wright. I'm a board member here today as a liaison to the committee.
So each of our standing committees have a board liaison that basically listens and then reports back to the board when we tell them what we've done in our meetings and how productive we've been. So we need to appoint a chair. And so if anybody's really interested in that position, you raise your hand. Otherwise, I don't know how we're going to pick one, but we need a chair. Basically, all you really do is do what I'm doing right now. Go through the agenda, keep things on track. That's about it. It's not hard. So, any volunteers for chair position?
I will volunteer.
Thanks, Ray.
But I'm happy to concede to someone else who would be passionate about doing it, too.
Okay. So, since that's the only person I heard, do we want to vote on appointing Greg as our new chair? Motion?
I move to appoint Greg as our new chair.
Second?
Second.
Everybody in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Evening. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate that. So, you'll just kind of go through and do, you know, if we probably won't do much voting yet until we kind of have more of a final piece, so there won't be a lot of voting today that you'll need to worry about. Sort of the idea where Julie and I have come up with is the first meeting we went through divisions 1, 5, and most of 10. So we're going to finish up 10 today, and then today we will look at divisions 20 and 40. And you'll notice that we skipped 30 because that's the bulk of disciplinary items. And I really recommend you really go through them before we present them over here. So we'll do the next one will be division 30 and 50. 50 is peer review. Once we have all the comments and we've discussed through each of the divisions, Julie and I will make those revisions and present it to you at your next meeting for sort of a final approval. If we can't come to a final approval, we can at least present to the board what we have thus far and then keep working on the other divisions that we're struggling with. And so that's kind of that's what we'll vote for. This is what we want to send to the board. This is what we want to send to the board. So, what we probably want to do is just review the agenda, see if there's any changes you guys want to make, and then jump in maybe to the division funding remainder. So, I'll let you take it from here. I'll start chatting.
Okay. Review and approve the agenda. Does anyone have any questions or suggestions on the agenda, or should we just proceed? Nothing.
The summary, you can see if anybody had any corrections on the summary that you were provided. Alex won't know because he wasn't here. What did you say it was like that?
It's a good quiet trip.
Nothing.
Yeah. That's a good excuse. Yeah. So does anyone have any comments on the summary? I have one question on it. Where we have instances where, and this is kind of minute, I think, but where we have instances where we know people's names saying, you know, whatever. I noticed that, for me, for example, pointed out the notice was not capitalized. Is it typical to have a name in there, or should it, if we're all in agreement on whatever the change is, would it make sense to have LRC committee said, you know, whatever that change is instead of the names?
We're trying to use less names in our summaries because sometimes we get a little bit wrong on how something was stated, so we kind of make it a little bit more generic in our summaries because those are public. And certain individuals sometimes will zone in on something if they have a beef with an issue, and so we try to just keep it real generic. So I don't know how it was written, I don't remember, but if it said your name, we can certainly just say the LRC agreed to, like, and make it more generic.
Yeah, that would be my preference.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Did we clarify on the records retention? I wrote notes that we were going to come back to that, but maybe we aren't going to come back to that.
Records retention. Oh, so yeah, there's a few things that we're going to go back to.
Okay.
But probably not today. We're just going to finish out Division 10, and then any tabled items, if we have time today, we can go back to those tabled items, or we can wait for the next meeting and kind of address any tabled items that we had.
Okay.
That's kind of the route we were headed towards.
Okay.
And if we forget any at our next meeting, you know, bring them up. We'll be ready for you.
Okay. Great.
Could you refresh my memory on something? And it's towards process.
Okay.
So, and I was thinking around, and before we get into it later, the 60-day, it's called buffer, for folks coming in where they accept a position elsewhere, they come in. And then, so those would be the reciprocity applications sometime. Yes, because they'd be licensed elsewhere. So that's what, because of the 2 weeks, that's why the 60 days gives them so much more time, because staff completes everything within a couple of weeks. Right? I mean, generally speaking,
yeah.
Because those don't go to the board. They're completed at staff level.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully they have all of their complete package in.
Yeah.
And so that really gives them a broader space of time. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
And that'll be for every reinstatement person, too.
Yes.
So if, you know, if they're inactive and they're working at a firm, they would need to get active.
Yes.
And I think we put some parameters around that.
Yes. I mean, that's what I recall, and it's what I was kind of pulling together and thinking as I was going through things, but I wanted to make sure that I was really clear. That way, you know, as we get further and I'm having conversations with members, encouraging them to be sure to be in compliance. That
it should actually help the licensees and the firms.
Yes.
Is that part of the tabled item, though, that we were talking, maybe I'm not thinking of the right item, where we were talking about going from inactive to active, that there was a loophole there? Was that part of that thing that we tabled, the 60 days?
No, no. It was more the folks that accept a position. They're out of state. They accept a position with a firm in Oregon. And
oh, okay.
So
and the 60 days.
They need
okay.
to be up to speed with an active permit to practice.
Okay.
So anyway, thank you for that.
So if there's no other questions on the summary, then we can move to public comment. And I have to refresh me for what that is exactly.
We have two members of the public, Amanda and Sherry, are members of the public, so that gives them an opportunity to ask questions like we just did, or
sorry.
Clarifications, or however you want to. It just gives them an opportunity to speak. So I don't know if you have comments right now or not. we can dive into the rest of Division 10. I think that we are starting back in Division 10 at branch offices, which should be around page 39 of your Division 10.
Okay.
So branch offices. The first change that was made is just a reference. It had the wrong reference for the OAR that associates with this piece. That was all for branch offices.
Except when we had LRC consideration.
Oh, sorry.
I know it's hard to read, but
I have this in red on my computer, so it's gonna pop out. So, okay, is it necessary to have a CPA present at a branch office? The board receives requests from branch offices, especially in remote locations or areas in the state lacking licensees who accept tax returns and then are shared electronically. So our rule states that if you have a branch office, there has to be a CPA manning that office during working business hours. But the way technology has sort of evolved, there might be a licensed tax preparer sitting in that firm, or even a receptionist that will receive items and then email, fax, whatever they do to the main office. And so we used to get a lot more requests for an exception for the branch office rule. You know, I don't know how important it is to have a CPA accepting. I guess the part that would be worrisome is if a member of the public came into a branch office that was called, you know, Smith CPA, thinking they were talking to a CPA, maybe they weren't. That could be a little bit deceitful or confusing for the public, and that's, I think, what the basis was for having this rule in our rules. But we, you know, I guess we can discuss what that looks like if we loosened it up a little bit. Okay. Any kind of...
Is that only for CPA firms that designate themselves as a CPA firm? Are we talking about CPA firms that have non-CPA owners?
Well, if it's a registered firm with us, it's considered a CPA office, you know, regardless of...
Whether the name says it or not.
Right.
So if we were talking about a firm in Klamath Falls and they happen to have a separate, another office in Lakeview, and the CPA owner, are back and forth between the Klamath Falls office and the Lakeview office, but they're not in Lakeview all the time, that would be an example.
That's a great example, yeah.
And we're seeing so much more in the way of remote workers, we're going to see more of it. I think this is going to become more and more problematic. And someone may have a shared space at a WeWork facility, for instance, or just maintain one office somewhere, and I think it's going to be problematic to keep this.
We see requests like, you know, a Eugene office that's also servicing like Coos Bay or Brookings, you know, that the remote locations that, you know, they're kind of underserved in terms of availability of CPAs,
yep,
especially on the coast or very remote Eastern Oregon, and so it's a little bit of a hardship for them, maybe, too.
Does the rule state now that it has to be 100% of the time,
yes,
at this branch office?
Yeah, a full time for the hours that they're open to the public.
I give you kudos for thinking about the change, and the reason I say that is I hear from our members regularly about how hard it is to recruit CPAs into those rural areas. And for some of those rural areas, traveling to Coos Bay is easy compared to traveling to some of the others. And I think this is very helpful because it helps service the communities too. And I personally would think that folks would know who their CPA is versus the receptionist. You know, they want to talk to Bob. You know, I think this tax season, so many of the members told me that they spoke with, like, every one of their clients because the people had confusion. So people were wanting to talk to their CPA. So, yeah.
So it sounds like... that might be a rule that we could loosen up again, loosen up a bit and propose some language. Does anybody see any concerns or that you think any language?
I think the supervision has to be there. you know, and I think if you can, if we can come up with some wording of guidelines for the staff when you're not there, and how the communication with clients go when you're not there, and making sure they have a good program in line if they're not going to be manning those offices 100% of the time, because that's where that becomes important, is the messaging and what clients are being told when you're not present. I know I have a pretty strict set of guidelines for my receptionist staff and what they're allowed to say and what they're not. And I think that maybe having to, if you can go back to your supervision of your, when you do those ones where you don't have to have, like an LTC can be supervised by somebody that's not in their office, and look at those, how that's worded and how that supervision goes, maybe something like that wording. I'm not sure what that wording, I've seen some of it, but not all of it.
Tax board rules.
It's a tax board rules, if we can look at that and see how they word that, because if you're going for your LTC's license, you can ask for supervision and having your tax returns reviewed, but there's a thing where you can go to their board and you can ask that that supervision not be in the same office, where you can do a kind of a disconnect there. And I wonder what their wording looks like on that.
Kind of remote.
Yeah. Maybe we wouldn't have to recreate the wheel. Suggestion.
Springboarding off that, I've got to imagine other states have dealt with this.
Yeah.
If this is UAA language, I don't know whether it is or not, but I've got to imagine other states have dealt with it. So I wonder if NASBA could help us.
How does this compare to other states?
You know, I don't really look at branch office in other states. Usually I'm going for like education, experience, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of things. But we'll certainly look at that. That's mm-hmm. That would not be problematic at all. So it sounds like we're okay on loosening it up a little bit, but putting some parameters on what we expect that branch office manager, what that looks like, you know, clear, I guess, rules on what the expectations are, for what that looks like. So we can come up with something on that. Okay. Should we move on to the next piece? Are we done with the office?
I think so. I mean, on this clause, would it read something along the lines of exactly how it's written, except for struck after the word who in the first sentence and then the remaining left?
Where
idea being that there is still someone managing the branch office mm-hmm. with an Oregon license. However, that person doesn't need to be in residence on a full-time basis during the branch. It's open to the public. Maybe adding in supervisory, you know, managing and supervising, for example. Is that kind of how we're thinking that would read? Because, I mean, sufficiently vague, maybe. Because it'd be hard to set clear parameters, like you mentioned. You know, what exactly managing and supervising looks like, it could look different, I think, depending on the practice, depending on the service lines, et cetera. But I just say that.
Right. Yeah, because we're really framing it right now as a tax drop-off spot, really, but it could be a full-fledged CPA firm that does, you know, other...
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm also thinking a branch office could be as simple as the office that does maybe a lot of the bookkeeping and the payroll, but doesn't do a lot of the tax work at that office, where you have another office that does the majority of the tax work, which is where the CPA is all the time. I don't know.
Any more thoughts or notes I can write down on that one? So I underlined who shall be in residence at the branch office on a full-time basis, and maybe kind of tweak that full-time basis and what that looks like.
We're good.
I'm sorry, one other thought on that?
Yeah, please.
It says it shall be managed by a licensee,
yeah.
But we have firms that are run by non-CPAs.
We have non-CPA ownership, but they're all supposed to designate a licensee who's responsible for those branch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know exactly what you're talking
sense.
About.
Makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. But would you be loosening that as well?
Well, I think what, based on what you're saying, it doesn't have to be what the firm designates as the office managing partner. It can, to the public or to their team, it's whatever they tell the board is running the CPA practice in that branch office.
Do you think there could be some confusion, though, thinking about one firm that I'm aware of that you know, has, let's just say, two partners that are CPAs and one that isn't? I mean, like how people key in on words, would it be like under the supervision of a CPA versus, how did that term go? I guess I'm just thinking those words, how they can get a little confusing over time.
So we currently, like I said, so for non-ownership of a firm, for non-CPA ownership of a firm, you still have to designate a licensee who is responsible for each branch, regardless of who is there. But I mean, I don't know how the language will come out, but I'm kind of envisioning that our language would still say that there would have to be a licensee available. Even, you know, so yeah. So if you and I are partners and I'm a non-licensee and I'm down in Coos Bay, but you're running an office in Portland, you would still need to be available.
Sure.
During business hours, maybe, but just not at that location.
Sure.
You'd be available by phone, but I still couldn't assume those duties
right.
of a CPA, right? So
yeah. Makes sense.
Hopefully our language will
That terminology sounds less confusing to me. From like a layperson looking at it.
Well, and hopefully you can pull in our non-CPA owned, you know, some of the language so it'll tie in with that. Hard to get back there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There's so many strikeouts.
Mm-hmm. We struck number four. Registration of staff practitioners moved this to number one of.
Oh, that's why.
Number one is the requirement to register for a firm. So, okay, we're good there.
Okay.
We'll pass on that page. The little mark there is just grammar. Okay, so under assumed business names, notice to board, a business organization registered as a firm under
ORS. Page 41.
Oh, wait, you skipped this part. Okay.
Oh, is there a change in here? Section 4 was stricken. It was
okay.
Just the requirement to register as a firm, so we couldn't reference it because it was stricken previously.
Okay, gotcha.
So I think, we're
you're down here.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Business organization registered with the board shall provide a written notice to the board within 30 days of any change of firm name, firm address, firm ownership, or change in the form of operating entity. And some of that, it looks like we just kind of combined everything into one piece instead of having A, B, C, D. And some of it was duplicative. So, just like when you have a license to practice here, you have to let us know if you have any change of address or all the stuff we want to know. So this is just making that same for firms, and it was duplicative.
Granted, it was in the language before, but for example, like firm address and firm ownership, if a new office is open, that would be a firm address. So that would be, but if new partners are added or somebody retires as a partner, it's covered by that as well.
We have firm ownership. Do you feel like do we need to separate ownership and partnership, or to me that's all encompassed.
Well, I was using the term. Ownership is a better word than what I was using as a partner, yes.
Okay, but you think it covers it. I just want to make sure that I think of them as the same thing, but legally it may not be, so.
Correct. I mean, it could be a PC, so it'd be a shareholder, and they wouldn't be a partnership. So ownership is a more encompassing term.
Okay,
yes.
All right.
So that's the opportunities we have for Ken.
May I ask a question? It was back on the resigned in lieu of revocation, that one. So it was just more of a question about. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll see. Let me see if I can find it. Sorry.
There's so many pages.
Yes. Let me talk while I'm looking. So I'm definitely in agreement about, folks having to state why they're closing down their practice. But I have a question about the clients. And so that was I think there's a piece in there where the names and addresses of the clients have to be provided to the board. Is that, and I don't know, and this is why I ask, is that kind of challenging for the client's name? Because all of a sudden their names are out in public. So is that sort of a privacy issue for the clients?
So I think your question is around when the board votes to resignation and leave revocation.
Yes,
right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So
it's what they have to do.
Right. And so a list of clients wouldn't necessarily be provided to the public if there was a public records request.
Okay.
That is mostly for the board to ensure that the person who resigned in lieu of revocation has properly notified their clients' mission.
Yes.
Protection. And so, we can tell them what to do all day long in their final order, but if we need to, we can go back and check, hey, Mary, did Stan give you his resignation notice and where to find your records, and that's kind of a due diligence thing that we've been trying to do with our orders.
And it was more around a question about that public record. So would names of clients have to be provided to someone if they ask? Then it wouldn't.
So I have to double check that with Angie, but I'm pretty sure we're safe ground there.
Okay, I didn't have a problem with the former licensee, having to fulfill that, but more I was curious about the public.
There's a pile right there that has to be 20.
This is like 3 tens.
Division 20 handles municipal audit. and municipal audit licenses. And Julie, I think I want you to go through this one if you would, because you're way more familiar with these than I am.
Okay. So it looks like page 2 is the first edit. Oh, so item B in number 2 is simply to, for consistency, to carry through out all the applications. We require that all applications be complete within 3 months so that you can't submit an application and a year or 2 years later finish that. It needs to be, you know, done and done. Number 3, little c, formatting-wise, I know this is silly, but formatting-wise, the CA does not work well with the Secretary of State, so we cleaned up the, so it doesn't look like any language changed in A at all. Just wrote that out. And the format, there again, in B for number 3, big B, it simply is to reformat the language so that it grammatically works. Number 6, approval.
That was just so,
yeah. So we no longer have the requirement to notify the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State's office now goes and looks on our website when they're looking for anybody. They want the most current. So they're not looking back at what we may have sent 30 days ago. They just go right to the website. So it's just kind of catching us up with technology. I think I got the easy section. I don't have any changes.
Seven
and ten
have already been deleted,
yeah.
So we just officially
deleted. Yeah. 720, number 1. Oh, there again. We don't send it out to the Secretary of State. They come and look for it. So same language changes, being consistent. Number 3, B, big B. Okay, so this is actually a change. This was something we talked about. First of all, the CPE penalty for reinstating your muni license seemed kind of steep because it's the same penalty. So if you missed your 80 hours or your 24 minimum annual for your full renewal, it's a 16-hour penalty. If you don't report the 24 hours for your muni, then it was still a 16-hour penalty, it's almost, you know, almost 100% penalty, which seems steep. But the discussion actually needs to be around, a lot of licensees let their municipal license lapse even though they've maintained their active license. They aren't doing muni audits, they have no need. But then when they are again, they come to reinstate. And should there really be a penalty? I mean, they're maintaining their license, they're doing everything they're supposed to be. It's not like they lapsed because they forgot. So the discussion then became around, you know, should we just remove the penalty altogether? They still have to do the 24 hours. They have to get caught up with their, you know, their municipal auditor license.
Might some let it lapse just because they're not doing the muni audits anymore?
Most of the time. Yeah. Because we see, we're doing renewals now, and we see, you know, the renewal comes in, and they just aren't renewing their muni license because they're not doing that work. 5 years down the road, if you decide I'm going to do that again, you know, do you need almost, you know, a 75% penalty on your CPE because you weren't doing that work for 5 years? I mean, it seemed kind of excessive.
Do they have to submit to the board for why they're not? I mean, there's no other status in a municipal licensee like there is with the other ones where you can go inactive or you can...
No.
It is or doesn't.
And we reach out to them. Like, you know, if you were a muni auditor for 5 years and then you renewed this year and you didn't check that box, you'd probably get a call and we'd say, hey, you didn't check the box, you didn't pay that $150, are you sure? And they're like, yeah, I'm not doing that work anymore. So, I mean, you know, we're touching base, but it's just a license they don't necessarily need to maintain right now.
Okay.
But then they do have to get that 24 hours again in, you know, the other thing we talked about is it's really the availability of those courses are somewhat limited. And so, you know, to go out and find 40 hours for your initial license, I mean, you're taking the bulk of what's out there. So to do that again when you reinstate, it just seemed a little bit excessive. So, but that's for your discussion.
Yeah. So just for clarification purposes, so then there would be no penalty
For a last community license?
That's for, yeah, the committee can discuss that.
As it's written here, there would be the standard penalty for a lapsed main license, but no additional penalty for a lapsed community license if I reinstated.
True. That's for discussion. They can we haven't made a decision. It's for discussion today whether they want to have any or none.
But that's what you're asking.
But as proposed,
that's what it would be. Okay.
I'm in agreement with that because the to have the permit to practice, I mean, that is a must. To do work in the municipal arena is a want. So you have to have the license you have to be admitted to the roster to do that, but it's a business choice versus, you know, a license to be a CPA.
Mm-hmm. And so would this allow for a difference in circumstance? So, for example, if somebody did let their license lapse and continued to do them, and it was a mistake, and they should have been licensed, should there be a penalty in that situation, as opposed to somebody who let it lapse just because they're not doing the work? And would this allow for that?
That's a good point.
Or why wouldn't you put language in to just say if you're going to let your license lapse because you're no longer doing it, you have to notify the board to tell us that? I mean, is that something you wouldn't want to know?
Well, they do at their renewal. They just don't renew it, and it's not, I mean.
Well, no, where you have to actually submit. If you're going to take the penalty away, you have to actually submit when you're renewing. I'm not renewing this because I'm letting this lapse and putting the board on notice that I'm not doing this work anymore. And in order to then not have the penalty from what she's talking about.
Well, and you could, I mean, if it's this committee's direction, we could come up with language that there was a penalty. There already is. I was going to say, if you let your whole license lapse and that includes your muni, I mean, you're paying a lot of money. If you let your license lapse and you reinstate your licensing, or say you just go late before August 29th, you're paying $810 for your license renewal. And it's $405 for the license and $405 for the late fee.
In the instances where they forget that there's one scenario, right, and then to purposely say, I don't need it anymore because I'm not doing that anymore anymore, and then, so I see those somewhat separated too a little bit.
In philosophy, it's like when somebody is inactive and they choose to be inactive, there's no penalty in CPE to go active again, right? So there's that step because it was a choice. It wasn't an oops, I didn't let my license lapse. But if you lapse, there is that additional penalty.
And there is a new reinstatement form, isn't there?
There is.
And that has the penalty in it.
It does currently.
I mean, with Scott having a background in muni,
many
years ago. but I guess the other check and balance on this is Secretary of State. I mean, what's different about the muni is you also have this other, you know, government entity that's out there too. I mean, to me, the check and balance would be they're moving through, I mean, they have to sign off on those audits, they're moving through that process. Also, that's going to be on the Secretary of State's radar if they're completing audits without a muni license. I mean, it seems like there the point is not the 8 hours of CPE, for example, but I mean, they should be right. Getting a fine.
And that part hasn't changed.
Right.
Nothing about that has changed in the rules. That same process would still happen, and they'd still go through the BOAC and the board if they were caught doing it without. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's for your discussion whether or not you think there should be a penalty or a small.
I like the change you proposed as it is.
Like no penalty at all.
I agree.
As it relates specifically to the media license.
Yes.
Right. Yes. Sorry.
Is there, since the crux of this is whether or not it was a conscious decision or not, and you don't want people to continue to practice if you don't have the license, is there any option to make it official and have an inactive status for a muni license, or is that just completely beyond the scope?
I mean, it's never even been considered since I've been here, but I mean, it's, I guess that would require them to notice us.
Yeah, it just makes the question, you know, it asks the question, and you can show that you made this choice purposefully.
Could they add a section to the renewal where they had to check and sign that I'm not renewing, as a confirmation?
Yes, another
Didn't that
box.
Save you some work?
then I'm having to check with them?
No, because then when they don't sign it, we still will. I mean,
trust me. Oh, okay, maybe not.
I think it's an interesting suggestion, Alex. I think the only thing that I would anticipate could be challenging is if they've got an active regular license and inactive mini license, it could create some confusion.
Mm. That's true.
As well as administrative. But
just out of curiosity, if somebody has a lapsed muni license, how long does it take for them to come off of the public lists as somebody able to do that type of work?
We try to update those lists after every board meeting because the board approves the roster, you know, any additions to the roster. Kind of like that's when we update the disciplinary action report as well. After the board has made all those decisions, then we put an update.
But in terms of somebody who lets their muni license lapse, or what we're talking about, how quickly is the Secretary of State informed of that?
Well, they're looking at our website, and so really, once renewals are done, there should be, I mean, that's when we'll know.
Okay.
They only lapse at renewal.
So there's no specific correspondence into the Secretary of State's Division of Audit saying these people did not renew their meetings?
We have done those in the past, yes. Okay. We run a fresh list for them. I don't know, because I don't think that we could identify who exactly lapsed during renewal specifically, unless we physically wrote down the list, but
so it sits on the Secretary of State's office to review what we have in our records for them to determine if somebody is a licensed municipal auditor.
And they do. I mean, Amy calls regularly. Mm-hmm. She'll say, like, when she's doing something, she'll have our website up, and she'll call and say, "I just want to double check because I'm doing this and I'm not seeing it. You know, is it new?" So she will call and double check. Mm-hmm.
So then, again, I guess to the point, when somebody lapses, they do not renew their municipal license, but they're perfectly fine on their main license, how quickly is that reflected in our website, that person no longer then has a valid municipal license?
As soon as their renewal is processed. Well, the day after their renewal is processed.
Yeah, because it goes on the license, you look that.
So, and do we have, and there is no, I'm catching up with where we are on things, but in terms of, so have we ever had a situation where somebody renews their active license but forgets their muni license and they have a grace period to bring it back on board? Which we do with main license.
I guess technically, yeah, till August 29th.
Generally, so if we get a renewal application in that shows that they have been a municipal auditor, if they forgot to pay but they reported CPE, we're going to call them and say, "Looks like you just forgot to pay." If they paid and no CPE, we'll probably give them a call. If they didn't pay and they didn't report CPE, we're going to assume that they didn't want it to go bye-bye. So so we do try and follow up and make sure that that's taken care of.
So then once you make that determination that they don't want to do it because there's nothing on there, that's when you remove them from the list.
Right.
Okay.
So the list itself is separate from the licensee lookup. I just want to be clear that the list is updated after every board meeting, and really we should after renewal season two if there's a gap.
Yeah.
But then the licensee lookup is updated from June to August, and it's a long process.
So it sounds like no penalty.
Oh, geez. So no. There's fees, though,
yes,
right?
There are.
So there's a penalty, but just not a CPE penalty.
And then the more than 2 years, if I'm remembering this right, Julie, they have to take different kind of community.
They have to, I think they have to do 40-hour.
They have to settle over.
If you've been lapsed for more than 2 years.
Yeah, the initial admission, 40 hours, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is that it for Division 20?
Yes,
it was.
So Division 40 is all about CPE. So on the first page, number 2, ethics CPE requirement, this is something I want to have you guys talk about. So generally speaking, every renewal requires 4 hours of ethics for active CPAs. We only require Oregon-specific ethics courses if it's your first time renewing. But, this is proposing to have Oregon-specific ethics courses on every renewal for everybody, not just first-time renewers. Oregon-specific courses, we have 25. Oregon-specific ethics courses that we've reviewed in office and approved to for CPAs to use. The nice thing about Oregon-specific ethics is that you're getting a refresher. So all of these rules that we're doing here will be part of 2020's ethics provider. So you'll be updated on all the newest and greatest rules that we're going to adopt. Oregon-specific also has a lot of real case examples. So any kind of cases that the board has reviewed, and if we see a trend, like, you know, we see certain trends that come and go with the times. And so the providers will give examples and show real case history and what how the board, you know, disciplined for this. And I think it's just, I don't know, I don't take ethics CPA for CPE, but it seems to me that it might be helpful to have Oregon-specific for all of our licensees. Now, you guys can talk away about what you think.
Well, from a provider's perspective, what's your kind of requirements going to be as far as who provides? For example, mm-hmm. Virginia. I teach ethics in Virginia. Mm-hmm. I have to be a licensed Virginia CPA in order to do that. Mm-hmm. Would that be an Oregon requirement then? You have to provide it in the state of Oregon as a provider. Would you have to be an Oregon licensed CPA to do that?
You don't have to be an Oregon licensed CPA to provide the class. Is that what you're asking?
If you want to teach an Oregon to teach the class in Virginia, you have to be a Virginia CPA. So you have to have a license. You have to be a licensee in Virginia.
We have only required that they be a CPA from any jurisdiction.
Active.
An active CPA, but not an Oregon CPA necessarily. Okay. Because some of the courses are offered by CPE providers that are registered with NASBA. I mean, they're not local. They're,
right.
You know, they're
I work for two of them, so that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, they're some of the bulk providers. So it's,
It just depends on what state you're in. Because both Tennessee and Virginia right now, they require that you have you be a licensee in their state to even provide the class. And I don't see, honestly, I don't see a ton of benefit in that myself. I mean, as somebody who's both taught regular ethics and taught Virginia and Tennessee ethics at one point, I don't know that being a licensee in the state makes a difference. When you look at the specific state classes, my biggest beef with some of them is how you can get that material and what that material looks like every year and how often they update that material. And I'm going to use Virginia as an example. Virginia tries to update their material every single year, and it has to go through a pretty stringent process to do it. By the time the providers have access to it, I mean, you're scrambling to figure out what it is they're trying to bring out in that year's version of their ethics program. So I just caution a little bit about when we get to Oregon-specific type classes and what your overall goal is to, you know, that you'd want to go to an Oregon-specific. Are you really, because I actually think sometimes in those specific, and Virginia kind of gets in the weeds sometimes on some stuff, and you lose the overall generalness of what the ethics is supposed to be about, because they're honing in on these examples of, you know, and they're not giving you any kind of, I know last year's was a little bit better than the one before, but it wasn't giving really a lot of good answers to the examples they were giving. So they weren't giving a CPA a good frame of here's what to do and here's how to do it and here's a framework of what. It just said here's what wasn't considered and kind of left it up in the air.
Yeah, is this an Oregon class?
This is a Virginia class. I'm using Virginia as the one because I'm the most familiar with that one.
Kimberly?
Go ahead.
Can I share a few thoughts? Just because I was on a guest for a long time when the Board of Accountancy had the CPE committee, So I remember when this conversation about adding an ethics came up, and the committee, of which I was a guest, but the committee, as I recall, chatted about a required ethics course because of what they were seeing, concerns around like the CPE audit and that sort of thing. So when it came up, and it was Oregon specific then, so which was, as I recall, three sections were covering rules and statutes and all of that, and then one section was covering one hour recovering cases. And I think that the process with the board from the outside working inward has worked very nicely. There's the approved sponsors. The CPE providers need to make sure they're getting the, let's call it the packet of information. That's not really probably the right term, but the packet of requirements of what they need to do. From a provider standpoint, it's very straightforward because the information's all there, hence to the point of having so many providers, out on the website. So people have lots of choices on those Oregon-specific. The largest overarching, number of complaints that I would receive as former VP of Professional Development of the Society was that there was like duplication, that folks were having to take the same thing over and over. I mean, there are a lot more choices now than there were then. Setting back, in the back of the room at board meetings, I can appreciate why there's some concern about going back a little bit Oregon specific because of folks not knowing rules and statutes and that sort of thing. It did help. I think that the biggest thing was, though, people just feeling like there were duplications. I mean, we certainly have more options available to people now than we did back then, too. I think Oregon's process much easier than several other states that I've heard
about. For me, it just depends on how far in the weeds you're going to go when you require an Oregon-specific class. That then turns the table a little bit on what's going to be in there and what makes that such a benefit to the state. And I'm looking at some of the other states that I know have state-specific ethics going, I don't know that this is a huge benefit to their state because they're in getting so funneled in on the state issues and what's going on in that particular state, they've lost, in my viewpoint, some of the overall factors which Circular 230 is all about, of making sure you hit home on some of those other things. And that's my only comment. If you're gonna go to a required Oregon ethics, we need to be, I think, careful and conscientious about how often you're going to require that class be updated for an Oregon-specific type situation, and then what you're going to require as far as how often, maybe, is it every year you're going to require that you take an Oregon-specific? Is it every other year that you're going to require it? That type of thing.
So our courses do include a highlight, at least, of the sections of rules that are relevant. So they don't necessarily cover peer review, for example, because that should be very specific to firms that are, not individuals necessarily. But they do cover at least a high level of each section of rule. They cover the AICPA Code of Ethics. They include case examples and then a link or reference to the DAR. I would like to say, so the thought came about initially, it was a board meeting probably a year ago when we started talking about this, where we had a respondent who said, the board should educate us more because I had no idea I was breaking rules. I had no idea I had to register a firm to do these things. I had no idea. And then right after that, I believe, was a work session, and part of the strategic plan is to educate more than discipline. And so the board has set out a really clear path for, getting the word out, keeping people out of trouble, right? Helping them find the right path, which is wonderful. And so this kind of seemed like a great way to do it, because all of those things that, that we see people sitting at the end of the table at every BOAC meeting and every board meeting are addressed in these courses. So at the very least, they would know about it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to keep some people from doing what they're doing. I mean, I don't. But
then the board could then come back and say, every 2 years for your renewal, you take a course that tells you you have to do this. So you made a choice, and it gives maybe a little bit more teeth. Like, you don't feel so bad then when you're saying, like, here's the discipline. I mean, you should have known. We gave you every opportunity to know. So that's where this idea was kind of born. So if that helps any with the discussion, it's, you know.
I think it's a great suggestion. And now you're jarring my memory, and I think after being in those meetings for 6 years and complaints committee, we hear that 1/3 of the time, 40% of the time. And as a practitioner who actually has been on the Laws and Rules Committee on the board, I still have a hard time. Like, it takes a lot to keep up with this and to remember it in when you're engaging in new ways. So I think it's a really good idea.
You're going to get a lot of complaints because it's gone from Oregon-specific for a number of years, you know, numerous renewals, to first year only, and thereafter you could take general. So you're basically kind of going back to where it started. I'm not saying that's bad or good, but I'm just saying you are, I know you're going to get a lot of complaints because I know how people would grumble at me across the registration desk for many years. So I'm...
Nothing comes without a consequence.
No,
right?
I understand.
I get that. And I think back to when ethics was first started here in Oregon, too, and I think there was like 2 providers.
Yes.
Maybe. And so I understood the repetitious and the complaints
about that.
We're hearing the same stories every year.
Right.
Nothing's getting updated. It's just boring.
I just looked and we have 27.
Okay, yeah.
So 27 is pretty. And the first time, I don't review those, Julie does that, but I did read a couple about a year ago, and I was really impressed. I'm like, I feel like this should go out to staff to read, because it really, it's twisted in a different way than how I think about it because of my position, but I found it really interesting, and I've worked here a lot of years too, and I still can pull off at that. So
here's one of the best CPs I've had
in
this world, really, and it was the board member from Washington that delivered it.
Yeah.
May I ask a question too, Julie? You made a statement that whoever's teaching it has to be an active licensee.
Who prepares the materials? Yes.
Okay, I've never heard of that before.
It's not an issue. I mean, we haven't had anybody apply or submit a course that didn't have an active licensee preparing it.
Okay, so, and that's in any state or Oregon only?
Yeah, in
only?
Any state.
Okay.
Now, for example, so Mark Hugh is licensed in Washington.
Washington, right,
and
right.
And he provides in Oregon and Washington.
Okay.
But
okay.
It's, you know, and we have several of them actually from local.
So that was development. Okay. That's on the development side. The teaching side? Though
we haven't addressed that.
Yeah, because I was going to say there's never that I would get really itchy about, just because it's not been a requirement nationally that instructors for classes have active permits.
Well, and honestly, some of these are self-study courses. Probably half of them offer self-study.
Right.
So, you know, there's nobody presenting at that point. So.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I didn't misunderstand.
Yeah.
So you can, to prepare the class, you just have to be a licensee somewhere.
Right. That's how it's been. That's how Martin set it up, actually, a long time ago. I don't think there's anything in rule to change it, but it doesn't mean we couldn't structure something if we wanted to be more specific. I don't think so either.
So that's more of a how would you say this?
It's a policy or a practice.
It's a practice on the document. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So let me ask a question. So are we envisioning, relating it back to the thing that prompted the person said, hey, you need to let me know that I shouldn't be doing these things. And as a board member myself for a number of years, we've seen situations where there's recurring themes, not from this person, but from this person, but they all kind of come back to the same point. So I'm guessing what we're thinking about doing is trying to focus on that and say, okay, if 80% of our issues are dealing with these 4 areas, we want to have the Oregon-specific CPE on these 4 areas. Is that correct?
It would be very easy to do if that would be helpful to the board and if we do make these changes. So every year, so the courses expire March 31st every year. And so December-ish, November, I start reaching out and saying, you know, this year there won't be a lot. Last year we didn't really have much in the way of rule changes. So reached out, there's not a lot of change this year. you can kind of go forth and they submit everything January, February. This year, there will be significant change, and so we try and get them a redline copy so they know where they need to be headed and, you know, still get everything wrapped up. If the board said, hey, you know, so one of our tools has been the newsletter, right, where we saw recurring issues. Maybe a board member writes an article, it goes out, but this would be another way we could say, hey, we want something on this in each course because we're seeing a lot.
So at this point, the board staff is in contact with the CPE developers,
yes,
the ethics CPE developers, and having a level of conversation. So again, if that's where we're going with the idea is that these are the recurring themes, then staff would be reaching out to these people as the program's being developed for this year or the next year because it takes some time to get it up.
Correct.
But here are the five things that seem to be really pertinent this year. We'd like you to have build that into the program. Is that where this is kind of going?
I would love to see that. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great educational tool for the board.
What would the rollout look like as far as, would you say when the next group of licensees renews it, starting the next mm-hmm. renewal is when the Oregon's business, I mean, you can't just dump it on me.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you know.
We would have to come up with some sort of a rollout, you're right. And you know, theoretically, these rules will become effective in January of 2020, which means I don't know that we would really require that of the 2020 renewals, probably starting 21, given the time.
Give them some time to figure out.
Yeah, we're pretty nice.
So there would be a phase-in,
yeah,
and that would be part of the language, because we'd have one renewal where they would still be under the old rules,
right,
and after that. So,
yeah.
So in effect, your people that were reporting 6/30 of 21 have 18 months to get that Oregon-specific class.
Right.
That's right.
And those phase-ins that you know, the board's always put in place that
right.
have been helpful to keep people out of trouble.
And we'd get the word out. We could put it out in the newsletter. We can put it on the website. I mean, word will travel. Trust me. I mean, it'll spread like wildfire, and we'll get a lot of calls. But
and I know OAIA and OSCPA have forums for the board to be able to give an update to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I can only imagine, we've seen in the last 2 years a big increase in the number of those providers, and if it becomes an every renewal requirement, I can only imagine that, I mean, we'll double, I would imagine, right? I mean, as the need is there, there will be providers to give it, so.
Yeah, I don't see that being an issue.
27 providers is not a concern.
Right.
I mean, I say that not as OSCPA, but
it
just
that's the reason I was asking about how often you're going to do the changes, and how often you expect, because they do. I mean, they do look at it at a cost benefit analysis. I mean, just like any company would.
Right.
And depending on how much they're having to change their program every year, and what kind of application process that they have to go through in order to be able to provide that in your state is going to dictate how many providers you have, which is why I was asking those questions, because that's where Virginia's running into some problems. They're so strict on how to get their material and how often and what their material is for the providers. It's very difficult to get it rolled out in a timely manner to offer it to their people, because of the way they're when their dates are. I mean, they don't roll it out. We get it maybe end of March, 1st of April. They're May 20, you know, end of May. And so you're trying to turn it around in a really short period of time. And it has to be these parameters. So I would just say, if you want a bunch of providers to be able to do this, that we need to be very conscious about how you're going to, what you're going to require. And though I agree, I think it's a really good idea to do something Oregon specific, don't get me wrong. I just don't want the amount of providers to go down because we're so stringent on what has to be in it and who provides it and all of that, is my only comment.
So far they've been very receptive. When we've asked them to include other information, they've been really receptive. Don't get any complaints, just tell us what you want there, we're good. So
yeah,
and they're finding a lot of the information because we keep the disciplinary action report on our website, so they can see the
issues that are coming up.
Right,
and the new format's very helpful for them because it's searchable. So mm-hmm. when they're discussing, you know, conflict of interest, they can just look for that. So they can search by the type of
discipline and find, you know, cases that are relevant and new, and so it's, that's been helpful.
And then we keep them up to date with our rule changes there on, you know, all of our today they can see what's going on. Okay, so I kind of am doing a thumbs up with some implement language to follow.
Will you refresh my memory on the content, so on the Oregon specific, where it started out with those three and one, like three hours were statute and rule, and then the 1 hour could be cases and so forth. You haven't really required that for a long time, I don't think. Yeah, that's, well, you know the junk I have in the back of my head.
Yeah,
I was going to say thank you, that in itself makes things a lot easier, doesn't it? But, yeah.
So I think the most of this is on this page is simply taking out the first time piece. Let's see what we have on page two. Number one, we're getting ready for online licensing. So we added that or attesting to, we are hoping to get you guys online license renewal in 2020. I'm not going to promise anything, but that's the goal. So by adding this language now, since this will be effective in 2020, is we may not require you to necessarily input all of your CPE. There will be perhaps an upload of your CPE into the system. Or we'll say, you'll attest that you've got your 80 hours and your 24 in each year, and you'll have a checkbox, and that will be, that's why this language is here, is to give us a little bit of flexibility on our changing renewal process, perhaps. So that's all that really means.
Can I make a suggestion on that?
It's a test.
I don't think we should use that.
I know, I always get nervous.
Sign or electronically sign or firm electronically for the.
What did he say?
Anytime we use the word attest or attestation.
Guys,
CPA is crazy.
That word in CPA is going to be like, hey, you need attest to it.
Yeah. You've got to have proof of you will be your
attest.
Sorry, can I ask a question about the previous topic?
Sure.
So I noticed that the second section talks about people licensing, sorry, 2B, former B, talks about people licensed in multiple jurisdictions and how their local licensing or CPA requirement could satisfy that requirement in this state. Would that still apply if we're going to Oregon-specific CPE for renewals?
I believe
they,
well,
I'm just I don't know.
So two new A, old B? Because
on the first page.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Striking the first section.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I can kind of go either way on that one. I don't have.
I get where you're. Yeah.
Is this saying that you're going to accept, if they're licensed in another jurisdiction, you're going to accept the ethics requirement for that jurisdiction over Oregon and not make them do both their regular jurisdiction and the Oregon specific? That's the way I'm reading that.
That's what it's saying.
That was from the initial development of the ethics course because of folks, for example, Colorado had their state specific requirement. So if someone worked in Colorado, I mean, their place of business was in Colorado, then Oregon was, at that time, recognizing that state-specific.
How do you guys feel?
I don't know. I mean, they've already met their requirements for their own state, why would we want them to have to take our Oregon one, too?
To me, it seems that if the reason why we're moving, considering a move towards Oregon-specific for all licensees is because of education of the rules. Somebody practicing in Oregon, whether it's on a reciprocal license or not, would still have to comply with those rules. And so then they would still have that same out that we're kind of taking away for the domestic licensees. You know, they would still potentially have the, well, you know, it's not that way in my state. I didn't know I had to do it in Oregon, which is kind of the point of making a change.
But aren't we saying that their state had their own ethics requirement? That we're accepting that, or are we saying that we're not going to accept that?
Well, it's up for debate.
Yeah. Right. Currently, we always have.
Yeah, I think that's honestly somebody who's licensed in more than one state. That puts a lot of burden on the licensee. Myself, I mean, to have to, I've already taken the ethics. You know, for that state, I've met my requirements, and if you say you're going to be reciprocal to that state. And then to require something on top of it.
Well, this would only be if you were physically located in the other state. Like you, because you're physically located here, you would have to have the Oregon, meet the Oregon requirement.
Right, but when I go to, say, Virginia, I don't have to take their class. They accept my Oregon license as standing and the Oregon requirements as such.
I think that's a little, the Muni is so different, but I think that's a little bit more in the vein of individual mobility, if you will. I mean, it's that concept.
So the idea of if a local state has a different definition of compilation, or to say, you know, if you're only doing one or two, you don't have to be registered, mm-hmm. And then they're coming, and then they're doing, working within Oregon potentially, they would have that out and say, well, I didn't know I needed to be licensed in Oregon, even though I only have a couple of Oregon clients, I don't have a firm here. You know, I didn't know I needed to register.
Would be the well, but isn't that a different situation being licensed in Oregon? Because if you're licensed in Oregon, maybe I'm not understanding your question.
If you have a reciprocal license and a domestic license, and technically then you're, it's kind of, okay. it's like your nexus, really. Mm-hmm. Okay. But you can still practice in multiple states, but whose rules do you have to follow, and how strict do we want to be about making sure that everybody who is serving Oregon clients have the same information and the same set of rules.
I think it's. I think the way it's written, it doesn't require that, and I think it would be too onerous to require it. I think good discussion.
It'd be a lot of tracking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you like it as it's written?
Yes. So the next one just goes, if your principal place of business doesn't have an ethics, you don't take ethics, right? Yes.
And the little c, I guess if we're going to talk about these, this is where we're going to talk about the rollout of this Oregon-specific thing.
We will put some language.
That would be right there.
I don't know where yet, but it will be there in that
okay.
section. Yeah. Okay, down to controls and reporting again. We already went through the test. We'll change that language. Two CPE programs. This is what we require from you to report on the renewal, the name of the sponsor, the program title. We didn't understand why or description of content was on there because every CPE program has a title, so we just got with a head scratcher first. We just took that one out. Then when we get down to page 3 and number 3, published articles and books, you'll see little d has date of first publication. We have seen more recently that CPAs who provide articles or books or whatever they do, they're claiming it multiple times, and so we are just allowing the first publication, and then later on we talk about if there's significant changes to your publication, you can claim it again, but we'll get through that later. But we're limiting this to the first publication, which is what we do for most everything.
Yeah, and it's not a change in practice. It's really, it's just clarifying.
Yeah.
Comment. You made the comment that it's all, phrasing it, all CP programs have a title. What if it's like a firm's in-house CP where they just, they cover a million things. They don't really give it a
like,
title.
Yeah, well, usually they'll do like professional update or, you know, weekly meeting.
So that would be sufficient.
Yeah,
even a weekly meeting would be sufficient.
Right.
Yeah, because on either on the firm report of CPE or the certificate of attendance that the firm provides for document for audit, it always has like a title or a there's something on it. And the trouble is that when you're reviewing 4,000 renewals, it's hard to track when people just make up whatever, like, oh, this was on, you know, you're like, I can't find
multiple,
a page that...
Multiple conferences.
Yeah.
We don't want that.
Yeah. So they'll describe it, and you're like, you can't find it. They have 100 pages to go through. Yeah. So, but there's always a title somewhere on there.
Especially,
great about that.
They're describing a whole page because they don't want it to be denied, and so you have to read the whole page.
It gets interesting.
I'm sorry.
No, the firms are the best about actually doing that. I mean, about providing some sort of title on there.
Yeah.
So.
Let's see. So, okay, going down to programs that qualify for CPE. let's see. Nothing big on one. We just kind of just make it sound a little bit different. Nothing big there. Number two, program requirements. So a little B was struck, and that's because we are introducing to you today a subject that I had a hard time wrapping my head around, but I finally got converted to nano learning. So we're going to start accepting 10-minute nano learning classes.
Oh,
no. So no longer does the program have to be at least 45 minutes in length. It has to be at least... Am I right?
Yeah.
So is it going to say at least 10 minutes?
It will later
on. That will be a definition. There actually is a definition of nano learning that comes from the... Did we get that off of the UAA? Okay. Yeah, so it's very clearly... Yeah.
Okay.
It's in the CPE standards.
So we'll just keep going down here. So for eligible programs, the first change under that is little D, where if you're going to take university or college courses as CPE, which we totally allow, we're requiring it that they be technical subjects, so not PE or advanced racquetball, nothing like that. So, and this is consistent with how we have our educational requirements for the exam. So. Generally, there always are technical, but we sometimes you have to.
We have a few that come through it. Yeah. And when you consider the quantity of CPE they get for a college course, so for a 3-credit course at a semester school, they're getting 45 CPE credits for that. Mm-hmm. So if it's not a technical subject, that's more than half of their CPE that they're reporting. That's Maybe they're learning. What was one course? It was about the weather, like learning all about. It was a college course, and that's it. But it's really not a
So technical subjects, is that
defined?
Well, I assume it's not defined because it's not capitalized. But
there's a list of technical CPE subjects in this section.
Okay, there is. Yeah. Okay, because it's as stated, so it's not. It's not to say technical subjects such as those stated, but there's actually a list.
Right, there it's in section 40.
Okay.
And it'll list, and it's quite extensive. And even you could go take a college course on Excel, and it would qualify, and it would help you as a CPA, right?
Yeah.
To know all the ins and outs of Excel, but learning how to read the clouds probably is not. I don't know that should qualify for half of your CPE credit for the 2-year period. So.
Right.
Under number four, individual study programs, we have introduced another new idea that I'd love for you guys to chat about. So we added letter B, individual study courses shall be limited to 12 hours per day. So the thought about this is we see, especially for reinstatements where they want to hurry and get back into the game, that they will take up to, and I can't even believe how they do this, but we can get 45, 55, 75 hours of self-study CPE in one day. You know, I don't know what that looks like for those people, but I'm guessing it's not, you're not learning 75 hours worth of technical material. So, and I don't think that's what the board is looking for, somebody to jam in 55 hours in one day of self-study. And so, we added this for your discussion to limit 12 hours a day for individual study courses.
So I think what this is doing, though, is it's limiting the number of courses taken. I actually really like long-form courses. So they have courses that are 20 hours, and you're not going to complete them all at one time, but you can do it over a period of time and come back to it, both the material and the testing. Mm-hmm. But then the date you complete is when it's going to show up on the certificate as being complete. Mm-hmm. So this would preclude that, which I would...
Is there a better number? I mean, like, do you think, I mean, I don't know how all that works on that end. I mean, I know how it works for different agencies, which is, you know, tricky. I mean, I guess I don't know how it works. It's baffling, but I get what you're saying. Is there a better, I mean, like, do you find, is there a number that would be a good limit that would still allow that?
Well, if it were entirely to me, I wouldn't put a limit on it. But if you're going to put a limit, I think 24 hours would be a reasonable limit.
Because, John, you're saying that people are taking that class all week, and then they successfully pass, and so they get a certificate that has one date with the full week's worth of credit.
So I did one last week. Actually, I've got it right here. It was a big one, and I downloaded it on a Sunday plane, and in my downtime when I was traveling, I came back to it, and I completed it on Thursdays, but I didn't do all of it on that day.
No, and that makes sense.
Well, I hate to, along with that, I mean, you do get the people who procrastinate and are doing the last of it. And because the penalties are large for not meeting it, if you had, say, 16 credits you needed and you had miscalculated or whatever and you didn't realize it and you're trying to cram it out in one day and you sit for 12 hours at your computer doing all of these credits, I don't think you should be damaged for that, because if you don't get it done, the penalty on the other side of that is extensive. So, and that's just a thought.
This is a hard one.
Let me toss out something. The whole premise of the CP is you're learning something along the way. And speaking as a board member, that's what I would want our people to do, is CP where they're actually learning something. And I understand, I have done it myself, where you go to class and go, that was a waste of 8 hours. I will never get that back. I learned nothing out of it. There's been a few times I haven't even submitted that class because I didn't get anything out of it. But I having seen this before, it is a case of, how much do they learn when they do that cramming that goes into it? I just throw that out as a thought process.
I'm not arguing your point there, and I'm not saying procrastinating is a good thing, but we all get caught in it, and I don't know that there should be a penalty if that's what you have to do in order to, because there is no grace period. I mean, you.
So a little perspective, there's another licensing agency in the state of Oregon that limits you to 8 hours a day, and you have to have all of your CPE completed and submitted 10 days prior to submitting your renewal, and there's no grace period. There's no 60-day, so you make sure you plan ahead. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like you.
Well, and I'm not saying there shouldn't be planning ahead. I'm right there with you.
We're kind of in a limbo where we're actually really nicer than that agency is. So
there's two different issues here as far as I'm concerned. What John is talking about, taking an extensive course that, let's just say, to learn that content is for, okay, let's just say there were a class that would cover 40 hours of every piece of that municipal audit, right? And you had to go all the way through. But at the conclusion, you get one certificate that shows your 40 hours. I mean, that's the positive. I mean, that's an educational experience. Mm-hmm. Versus, I recall, on the CPE board, CPE committee, the person that had three different courses all the same day, if I can remember,
you know, who was the committee members sitting across that were really upset about it. And I mean, that's the part where people are taking advantage. They're just blowing through those, and we all remember when there was CPE where you paid $1.44 a credit, and you're basically opening up, you know, a tax guide to find the answer through. I mean, that's the extreme that is the negative. So it's like if we could it's very complicated, but if we could somehow factor in that positive side of John's, but yet the safety net that catches these folks.
I wonder if there's some way to develop language that allows for, you know, like you can't take 27 courses in a day that are a credit, two credits, you know, and just stack them up.
Right.
You're not, but if you do have a bigger, it might get too complicated, I don't know. But
unless this contradicts the nano-learning section we haven't gotten to yet, I mean, maybe the cap would be on number of certificates eligible for a particular day as opposed to number of hours. Because if you could say, oh, we're only going to accept CPE credits for up to three courses on dated the same day, or two classes dated the same day. And then if you get one class, with, you know, one certificate on one day with 40 hours, that's not outside the rules. But if somebody tries to submit five courses all for one day, then that would be, because then that is kind of then bringing into question the value of the education they got.
Unless they're taking half-hour nano credit or 1 hour. I mean,
right.
People will reinstate 176 hours, and they're all in one and one and a half credits. I'm not kidding you.
That just
sounds it's
so much
this much paper. It's a lot of...
It's a nightmare.
It is. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, there again, I mean, you don't want to limit them. If they could take 8 or 12 of those single... I don't know.
You could say that,
yeah.
You know, you could have more than one certificate as long as it's less than X so many hours, but no more than overall number of certificates. It does get into a bit of a, one class is fine, 12 classes is fine if they're all a half hour, but 12 classes is not good if it's 8 hours.
Right.
Or like
each.
12 hours or one course. I mean, can you, like, whichever is...
Well,
you know
but
I mean,
to the point of view, if you get into the nano learning and somebody's going to have a whole bunch of 20-minute classes, which adds up to 8 hours, so it's perfectly doable within a day.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We don't want to, in theory, would we want to preclude that then from being eligible?
Well, that's no different than sitting in a class for 8 hours
right.
listening to an instructor.
I have a question. So in the CPE audit side, can staff, I know there's a process, but can staff place people into the basket for audit? Like you see one of those situations, can you select them?
It's random.
I guess I'm thinking, could there be a spot where they could be placed in? I'm just thinking again about the piece that looks flagrant versus the piece that looks legitimate.
Right, but you could have a piece that looks flagrant that is totally legitimate, because if you did sit for 8 hours and watch these videos, honestly, no different than sitting in an 8-hour class at a live lecture. Why would that be any less acceptable than sitting in an 8-hour live lecture class?
These nano pieces are not the pieces that I would think are the problem. They're the piece where somebody claims 3 8-hour courses in the same day. Their certificate has comp and review for 8, tax for 8, and pensions for 8. They're all the same day. I mean, that one seems more suspect to me than someone that's going through nano, and also the person that goes through 40 hours of extensive, let's just say, international taxation because they feel like they really need to, and they're going to have 120 hours by the time they report anyway. I mean, those seem like three different scenarios.
I don't feel like an audit would satisfy that. It would solve that problem, though, because they have their certificates.
Yeah,
that doesn't
mean
that, you know, John doesn't have three laptops going next, right, on a self-study.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, it, not that you do that.
Not anymore.
That's another great example.
I only have two laptops.
Right, there you go.
Have other states contemplated this? Do we know?
That would be another great... We can do another quick
just one. Practically speaking, because I think I do my CPEs maybe like you. I do big CPEs, usually textbooks alike. It allows me the flexibility to work, you know, do these CPEs when I travel. It may take me months to get through something. Oftentimes it does. And just with my schedule, practically speaking, sometimes I do fill out, like, and I'll the way these things work is there's a test in the back, right? You kind of go through, do the test as you're learning and going through the textbooks, and then, you know, you go to the exam at the end, you submit it. And that's the process. And I may submit multiple tests in one day because, oh, I've got 2 hours to spare. I've been working on this for the last several months, several courses maybe. So one day may, for me, have multiple certificates. That just happens to be the day that I submitted the test to capture those credits to submit to the board. But I don't think, you know, my schedule or any practitioner's schedule should preclude them from, you know, doing that. While I agree it may look suspicious, or I can't remember the word used exactly, but there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think. The objective of CP is still met. It's just the certificates may look like everything was submitted the day, but the work behind that was not, and the learning that occurred. And so for me, this doesn't seem like a good add, because it may just on the surface level at least preclude someone from submitting multiple courses in one day, for example, or large courses in one day. Just practically speaking too, I don't know how that would be enforced, such a rule.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think we can regulate this. I just think it's
they're probably going to have problems in other areas.
What's that?
I mean, if they're doing that, I mean, if it's not legitimate, there's probably problems in other areas too.
I don't know how you test learning.
Do all of your hours have to match the certificate date? There's no way to say I worked on this in 4 hour chunks.
No, because like he says, when you submit it, that's your date.
It just has to be on the date.
And the certificates don't say started and completed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they don't say really how long it took you to do it. Because you can get those, I know I do. I get the self-study ones, and I may carry that around with me till I have time to look at it, and I'm like you, I may do the test along when I'm reading, and I could have 4 or 5 of those that I submit all on one day, just because I'm back in the office and I'm at the computer, you know.
Is it more comforting to hear how everybody's doing this, to maybe feel like maybe it's not so blatant?
Yeah, that it is very helpful.
It's definitely a personal pain point of mine when I'm hearing fellow CPAs brag about how quickly they can click through some of these CPA things. So I like the heart of what this is trying to do, but I would also agree the enforcement would be very difficult.
Yeah, I think there's two sides.
Well, and I get where you guys are trying to catch the people that aren't necessarily doing the learning. They're just going and...
Well,
we'll catch through it
at the board. They'll come back through.
Yeah. Chance to
it does.
John will see them later.
So we obviously have lunch. Do we want to like take a quick little, you know, break for eating and bathroom breaks or whatever else, and then get into the rest of 4 years of blended learning and all this other good stuff?
Sounds good. Yeah.
Okay. Your lunch is over there. They may have to use your arm.
Julie.
Okay, so we are back from lunch break and we have Michelle with us now. So Michelle, we are on division 40.
Okay.
And we're on page 4. And we're going to start with blended learning.
So did we decide, was it the consensus was we weren't going to do B? Okay, I struck it out, so I just wanted to make sure that...
I think an alternative would be if there was question, we could audit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 5, blended learning. This is all new language as well. This is where we'll talk about... some different types of learning that we are going to talk about. So anyway, blended learning. Blended learning program is an educational program incorporating multiple learning formats such as lectures, discussion, guided practice reading, games, case studies, and simulation. I wasn't really sure what blended meaning or learning was until I read the definition and the standards, but I think this is a great way to learn personally. I mean, different people learn different ways, and so whatever. I think that's sort of a no-brainer to me. But if there's any questions, this is what the training at CPE is doing: blended learning, nano learning. So nano learning was a little bit harder to me to understand. So nano learning program is a tutorial program designed to permit a participant to learn a given subject in 10-minute time frame in a 10-minute time frame through the use of electronic media without interaction with real time instructor.
I think that came straight up.
Mm-hmm. A nano learning program differs from self study in that it typically focuses on a single. Focuses on a single learning objective and is not paper based. A nano learning program is not a group program. Nano learning is not a substitute for comprehensive programs addressing complex issues. Evidence is satisfactory completion of the course. CPE program sponsors of nano learning programs must require participants to successfully complete a qualified assessment with a passing grade of 100% before credit is issued, which is interesting and good. Assessments may contain questions of varying format. Only two questions must be included on the qualified assessment. True and false are not permissible. On the qualified assessment, if the participant fails the qualified assessment, then the participant must take it again.
Can you move back to C? It's not a substitute for comprehensive programs addressing complex issues. Are you suggesting there that you're going to limit the amount of what can be used? So CPAs are going to have to make sure that it qualifies with Oregon.
I think this is kind of a general, this may even be a CPE standards.
Yeah.
So I don't think that you can have any complex issues in 10 minutes, probably. I think that's the...
I mean, is that...
I have the same question, though.
Is it leading you to have to get approval before you can take them and know they qualify?
No.
That was my question as well.
Okay.
It seems that C through H are pretty darn specific. So are these, this is the definition, but were these taken from our rules?
They were taken from the CPE standards off of the UAA. My take on C was more, I think of it in terms of, so, you know, we have a rule in WET Division 30 that says you're not allowed to perform any work that you're not competent to do, right? So you can't say, oh, I've never really done an audit, but I'm going to take this 10-minute nano, I don't think I got it. You know, if there's a complex issue, you need to take a program that's going to teach you all the ins and outs. This is to, you know, get little updates, right? That's the way I read it.
I always think about things going back to this 801-040-0030, which is down a little bit below, programs that qualify for CPE credit. And it's we've referenced this so many times when people are asking questions, that CPE must be a formal program of learning that contributes directly to the professional competence of the licensee. And when you kind of go through that paragraph with people, they're always like, oh, okay, I get it. And I think that paragraph is really helpful as we move towards nano learning, right? Because it helps people frame in that whole idea that it has to be of value.
Mm-hmm. This just led me to believe that maybe there was some other list I'm supposed to be looking at to see if there's other issues. Just because you're saying complex issues, that this isn't a substitute for comprehensive programs addressing complex issues, doesn't mean they're not going to be offered. And so that's why I was asking that question.
Right. We took the language straight from the UAA, from the CPE standards, but...
Are we going to limit the amount of this nano stuff you can submit?
I can't imagine.
I Yeah,
I mean, somebody would take that with it.
We see the majority of nano learning coming from the big firms.
Okay.
So Ernst & Young is one firm that puts out a lot of, and so, you know, they're not reporting all their CPE in nano learning, but they're definitely, when you ask them about, because we have to call them and say right now, we have to remove all these 0.2 credits, those don't count, right? And so if generally they're not right at 80, but if you were and you think that it's available, mm-hmm. right, you call and talk to them and they say it's really great learning. Like it's mm-hmm. it's very specific to an issue that they're dealing with. Maybe on a specific client right now, I need this information.
That's great.
It's better than wasting an 8-hour day sitting in a classroom, right? I mean, you get more information out of that. So sometimes you don't know where you'll get that good information.
It's good to hear that it's practically working. We've been learning about this for 5 years,
yeah.
hearing about it. But
we've been really afraid of it.
Are you afraid of the administrative
program? Yeah, a little bit. Not now.
Okay. So you're totally good with it?
Question on just on the format. So paragraph 5, paragraph 6, certainly from C seem to be definitional. Should they be in division 5 as lead in and then just
it could be, yeah, and I think when I was reading this out loud, because you know when you're developing your describing and stuff, but I don't think we'll use the language here, but maybe we'll format that a little bit differently with different headings, because some of this gets into the...
And then on paragraph 5, where it's the definition of what blended learning is, mm-hmm. does it get used anyplace else?
I think so. Yeah, so...
Well, it really should go in Division 5 as well.
Yeah.
But I guess what would we be curing by having a definition of blended learning? I mean, is there something that's come up already that, I mean, it's good to know, but it doesn't really mean anything?
No, well, that's sort of, when I saw this and it's a new thing, to me it's like, well, this could have been any individual study program, this could mm-hmm. be at any yeah. OSCPA program, so yeah. to me it was just a different name for a format we probably are already using in CPE.
I don't think it hurts to have it in there because this is an area that people will go to the website when they're thinking about renewals and look at this information.
Yeah,
and we do get those questions.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking about something through lunch. We were talking about the type of learning, you know, with the 12 hours when you guys were talking. We were talking about that. Is there any thought to the board putting a requirement out there as to how much of each type of learning you'll accept?
I would advise against that. The reason I would advise against that is because licensees are spread across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be really onerous for folks if they, you know, they required, for example, so much group study.
For what it's worth, I do know that the Washington Board of Accountancy is also currently looking at their nano learning rules, and I think they're talking about putting something of a cap at like 10 or 15 hours per renewal period. Mm-hmm. Partially because they know that it's not intended to cover complex issues, which probably are something that most of us should at least have, at least, you know,
right.
within a renewal period, knowing the types of issues that they're designed to teach to. I think that's why they're doing that.
Well, and that's what I was saying is if we're concerned about the type of learning and are people really getting something or are they just slamming it out when we're talking about the 12-hour thing, if you're putting some caps on some things or requiring certain types of learning, maybe not every period, but every other period or something like that, would that get you to your learning where you guys are more, assured mm-hmm. in when people are turning in their CPE that they actually got learning out of it? Because I think that's where you were going with the 12-hour thing. And so would you have a bigger level of assurance if that learning was a little structured on what types of learning would be accessible to the board and in what amounts?
I'd say nano, in my opinion, nano might be one thing, but I would hate to see that limited. I mean, like, you can only have so much self-study and so much group study, and so I would really be worried about that.
If we do that, we also put people in remote geographies
at risk.
And then the public is not well served if we make it harder for CPAs.
Okay. Just an idea.
Yeah, I had the same actual thought. We were trying to figure out how to regulate that.
Right, because I can see the point of, you know, something taking a long time, and I do that. You know, you do all your certificates on one day, and I totally get that. But I also get their perspective of they're looking at when certificates are gotten and how do they know that the learning actually happened, and how do you blend those two things together to where the assurance is there that the learning's happening, but we're also not handcuffing the licensees.
Well, I think we've never had before an entire contingent of CPE-type classes that are intended to be non-comprehensive, that are intended to be, you know, intense on, like, one little very, very limited subject and very limited in nature and in scope, whereas the other ones aren't necessarily intended to be that limited in scope.
I mean, you know how you study. What do you think?
I'm a huge proponent of these nano learnings, actually. I think I think they have their place. I think they're great to get updates on book and tax, things that are changes, things that are going on in the industry. They're not great to do a deep dive on something, but they're good just to do a surface level check on, you know, take a pulse on some accounting area. Mm-hmm. I really like the idea of having a cap on it for multiple reasons, not the least of which is administrative burden purposes, I can imagine. But I think as far as serving the public, you wouldn't want to have CPAs doing their entire learning on nano trainings.
Yeah. And I hadn't thought about that. That was a good point because 10 to 15 hours of 10-minute things, I think that sounds like a fair cap to me. And I don't feel like we, you know, we talked about the cap on the other things, and now I have a better understanding of how some of these self-studies work. And so I'm okay not really following those, but I think it is a good idea.
What would happen, just thinking, you know, if we tried to be kind of in line with, I mean, I'm not saying follow exactly, but sort of in line with what Washington does, because there's a lot of people that have dual licenses and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Example.
Right, I mean, yeah, and I'm not bringing it up, I mean, how do I say this? Amanda brought that up, but I guess sort of following that neighborly path.
20 hours, is that what you said?
I think it's like 10 or 15 is the cap that they're keeping around.
Which are a lot.
That's a lot of nanos.
Yeah. I mean, 10 minutes.
What would you suggest if you were keeping
them? I would suggest 10 hours seems like a lot of nano learnings. That seems fair to me, but of course it's super subjective, right?
That's 60 courses.
Yeah.
Are you going to? I mean, 10 minute. So are we talking about 0.2, or are we talking about 10? I guess either.
So good, well, yeah, that's a good. Okay. So how do you? Is the lowest 0.1? Because we wouldn't want to get into fractions of it,
you know. Yeah. So the definition of nano learning was that it is a 10-minute time frame, so it's 0.2 credits. But yeah, so 10 hours, that's 60 nano learning courses. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Is that in one reporting or one year, one 12-month period? I mean,
24.
Is that just one 24-month period or one 12-month period?
Within the 24.
One renewal period.
I guess it's 50. I was going on a 60-minute
orbit. Well, because over 2 years, over a 24-month, that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, 10 hours isn't that much over 24. I mean, yes, it's 60, but over 2 years.
But that's 50 courses in 2 years.
For 10 hours.
Mm-hmm. Where is Washington at with their kind of deliberations of this?
I know that it was brought up at their last board meeting, and that I think that's the direction that they're going.
I'd be interested to hear from them on their cap. Yeah, but just like what went into
it. Well, I would want it to be a good amount. I'm not saying overdo it, but, you know, I don't want it to be running up against, if it's somebody's practice and how they do things, you could, I mean, if you were doing so many a week because you were looking at technical issues, that cap would, you could meet it at 10 hours.
Yeah, sure.
Definitely, and could be over.
Yeah.
So we're in favor of capping it. We just don't know what our cap is going to be. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, let's find out what Washington is doing and bring it back.
And we can we're going to be in Utah with all the other state boards here in a couple of weeks, so we can ask around there too.
Perfect.
I know they'll be talking about it.
Question on new pair, little F.
Yes.
Only two questions must be included in the qualified assessment. Are we saying that there needs to be a minimum of two questions per assessment, or are there two questions that must be asked and they are?
Well, what I'm thinking in this, I think this is information for the providers, and so I think it means if you're a provider of a 10-minute nano class, you have to have at least, you only have to have two questions. Yeah.
So I think it's saying that you must have at least two questions, but it would seem to be better phraseology.
I would love to tweak some of this, but we put it in there straight out.
Okay, so this is just, okay.
Yeah, this is straight out.
Because again, it's almost reading as if they must include these two questions.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And when I was reading, I'm like, okay.
So we could say at least two questions must be included. This.
A minimum of two questions.
Okay, any more on nano or blended? Over to programs not eligible for CPE credit. So, you can't claim CPE for courses taken to fulfill the requirements for licensure as a CPA. What that means is there's a specific ethics course you have to take to get your initial license. You can't use that 8-hour class to, okay. Ethics courses that were taken to fulfill the ethics exam requirement for licensure. Are those the same thing?
Well, I think the first one could also be like your college credits that are going toward your initial hours requirement.
Oh.
Which I don't know in what circumstance that would ever happen.
I kind of feel like you.
But these are there, right? You're not suggesting you change
that. That makes sense. Yeah, well, the only thing we took away is the CPA exam, just any review or study courses.
We've been seeing an increase in the number of people calling about, so say I'm taking the exam review course to become a CFP. So the courses that you might take to become a CFP would qualify, right, because they'd be technical in nature and those courses would qualify, but the review course, kind of in line with the exam review course not being eligible for for the accounting bucket, that discussion. That was where that thought process came, that review courses aren't new material.
I would suggest keeping the word exam in there, though, because I understand grading CPA, but review or study courses could be all the CPE that...
Yeah, it feel okay. Like I just, I'm a CFF, like financial forensics, and I put that review course as CPE in the submission, not a CPA review course, but... That was a lot of training that I took in order to qualify to be a certified financial forensics. Mm-hmm. So that would be okay.
For the course, but not like a review. The actual classes you take would be technical. But if you did like, okay, I'm going to be taking my exam next week, I'm going to read all these review courses, no. That's what that's saying.
Okay.
Do we want to create this stuff, though?
That's up to you guys.
Because a little portion of those are how you test, how you take the exam. Most of it's very topical, though.
I've always thought the review courses, there's a lot of learning there in those review courses. But... That's just me.
How often do you find people submitting for their CPE that have a review course on there? Like we have to say, no, that doesn't count.
That's hard to say. I'm sorry. I mean, I really need to go back and look because...
So probably not that frequently then.
Well, we're not. Yeah, we're crazy at all. We have had an influx in those questions, though, this renewal period, I've noticed.
and...
Is the basis of thought is that they're just not comprehensive enough, or...
Well, I think the thought process is that you've learned, and then now you're relearning what you've already learned as a, like a refresher. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the thought process.
That's for the amount of, I mean, I kind of get why you don't do the CPA one, although for the amount of time you spend in the CPA review course, it's not like you're just... You know, I mean, it's an in-depth look at stuff. There's probably more comprehensive learning going on in some of those review courses than there is on a lot of the CPE type situations. So I've never understood why, you know, maybe you're to get your initial license, but if you go back and you're getting other licensures, such as the CFP or the forensics or something, that's adding to and probably more comprehensive than any self-study you would do on some of those self-studies.
So like using the CFP, so the CFP exam is structured a little differently than the CPA exam, where you've got a course and then a test, and then a court, you have like six courses, and then you have a board exam, and then you have a capstone and things. And so what you're saying is that the actual like courses that you would take to get through the program would qualify.
Right.
But if at the end, before you took your comprehensive exam, if you took a review course in preparation for the things you've already covered, then that wouldn't qualify.
Right.
Okay. Even though technically somebody could say the entire thing is in prep for the COP exam.
Yes.
Right. It was on the heels of the board discussion about the CPA review courses, whether or not they would count as, you know, upper division accounting. And the discussion, I think this is where we started adding this language. The discussion was that, you know, a review course is going back over. And yes, there might be some new content, but largely, it should be a review of stuff that you've already learned in all these other courses. Mm-hmm. And so you're getting credit for all those courses, and then you'd be getting credit for a review. So the review course is not considered accounting, upper division accounting. Okay. It counts for the overall credit. So that was the thought process behind this language.
Okay, so the intent is more specifically to exam review and study courses as opposed to general review, because it could be said that, you know, I'm a CPA, and, you know, let's say I took a class on how to prepare a 990, you know, 5 years ago, and I take it again now. Is that a review course because I've already taken it, or is that again? You know,
right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because it is something I've already learned, it's something I've already done. It's technically the same class and the same thing.
No, and these are specific. At least the ones we're seeing are very specific. It's just a review for, you know, for a licensure, like taking a Becker course to review before you sit for the exam.
Okay.
That's what we're seeing. But it may not be, I mean, we may not be seeing the whole picture, but that is where that thought process started.
Okay.
And I can't imagine the fact pattern where you'd actually see Becker, because they would have done that.
Yeah, that's right. That was my example.
Yeah, no,
of,
exactly.
You know, so.
But if I use that as the proxy for any other exam, mm-hmm. you know, going back to what you said, that's actually really, really good content. So the question I'm asking is, do we really want, or it doesn't sound like we prohibited it in the past, so do we want to prohibit the fraud examiner content from CPA?
Yeah, that's the discussion point. It was, yeah.
So yeah, we had CPA exam review was, I don't know, or study courses, and then we just struck CPA exam to cover other review courses, but this is where.
Well, the way I think about it is, any piece of CPE, if you've been out practicing at all, is not necessarily all new information to you. Mm-hmm. It's all review. You go to a tax class, even a federal tax update, mm-hmm. and you got to know the basics of tax to even take the class to know what it's talking about. And yeah, there's going to be snippets in there of things that are new or a different focus that we might put, but it's all review. Most of it isn't new law. Well, I mean, this year was.
But using this year as an example, I mean, I could have gone out and taken CPE classes from five different, you know, federal tax updates from five different providers. They're all covering the exact same information. It's the changes on the new tax bill and what are the new forms and all of these things are all just different variants of the exact same information, yet those would count.
Right.
So just
I don't know that duplicates of, if you took federal, you know, 2018.
From different providers.
Right, but if you took 2018 tax update from five different providers, I don't know that we wouldn't look twice at that.
Oh, okay.
Because that, I mean,
what's the point?
Yeah.
But why would you?
Well, because, I mean, I could,
people take duplicates in this, like this here, they're taking duplicates because it's so complex. I would argue the opposite side, not being a practitioner, sorry, but I would argue the opposite side. People can't remember everything, you know, and you have different points of context when you have different points of client needs come up, etc. But the classes are not all, I mean, they're not exactly identical, even though they can cover
the same,
the similar subject matter. I mean, you may get one instructor that's pushing down a little bit more into multi-state issues, and another one's pushing down into more in tax. And
and when you have so much change, yeah, everybody.
Just my opinion.
Would be unusual, probably.
Both because of the, I agree with the relearning, but also I keep going back to your CFE example. You couldn't get credit for that, but I can go in and do get credit every year for forensic auditing, technical credit for forensic auditing courses. So I don't, just my opinion, I think we should do it as is.
Do the CFE exam in there?
Or strike it entirely, because I don't think that. I don't see anyone going back to retake or to take back or after they've already gotten the license. And if they do, it's actually great content.
Yeah, I agree.
So is the intent more to strike just CPA and say, if you're taking something that is specifically for an exam review, that, you know, the point of reviewing stuff you've already learned for the purpose of passing a test, that's not going to qualify. But the prep work that you do up to it, those types of things. Okay, so whatever the exam is, if it's specific to pass this exam, probably not. But any of the other supporting work could be okay.
Correct.
Okay.
That's the intent there.
And I think part of my take on it is when we see the number of credits that are claimed are earned for taking one course. If you're taking the courses and you're getting 45 or 90, you know, you take two courses. That fulfills your whole obligation for CPE. So then if one of those is just a review of something you've just done, you have no other CPE required. And while most practitioners do not take advantage of that, I mean, I am completely comfortable saying most don't. There are some that do. And so, you know, it's...
So I guess maybe...
But that's not necessarily...
And if it is a review of something that you've just done, that class that you originally took counts. But then you wouldn't get double credit then for the review of that class.
I guess I get what you're saying about CPE.
I wonder if we've lost our way a little bit. I mean, it seems to me the initial was CPA exam review or study courses. So meaning that you can't or you should you can't claim a commercial CPA exam prep class, right? I mean, that's what it was intended for, but. I mean, isn't that what we're still trying to accomplish? Whereas the example that Greg was just using, I mean, isn't that CPE, right? I mean, if it enhances his professional competences, back to that golden rule I always call it, you know, enhances his professional competence as a CPA in the area of public practice, isn't that identifying paragraph what, you know, he might have to substantiate why it would enhance his practice, right? Whereas this is just to become a CPA in the first place. I mean, that's what I had always understood this to be.
Mm-hmm. Which typically doesn't, well, no, because you do have to have a certain amount of credits up front.
Yeah, the problem I think you run into is these review courses. Like for me, my review course was not really a review. It was a course that I took and learned all about forensic accounting and the areas that I didn't know about before. It came with a textbook. It was like 8-12 hours of content with an instructor. And even maybe it did have review in the title. It really wasn't, for me, a review. It was new content, things that were adding to my practice, to me as a professional. And to caveat or qualify this, seems like it would preclude someone from leveraging those resources in order to qualify for CPA, to maintain their CPA, which doesn't serve the public, I don't think, in any substantive way, although I do get the point on review courses as it relates specific to the CPA exam, because presumably that should have been addressed prior to being a CPA. But then I can also see
it can happen for the first renewal, it could happen.
It could, okay.
But.
So they wouldn't have submitted it, so in that instance, they wouldn't have submitted that for, qualified for their, yeah, initial licensing. They are holding on to it and submitting it as CPE.
Well, it would just be on their transcripts. I mean, a lot of the CPE review courses are taken through colleges, not through mm-hmm. Becker, so those could be used. Mm. Not, I mean, you know, it would be a timing thing. I'm not saying it would be a prevalent issue.
Okay.
But that's already excluded in the mm-hmm. current rule, so that's.
I guess I have a different thought process when it comes to review, because even if, let's say you were going and getting your four-year degree to be a CPA, and the college offers the review course, it's all about prepping up and building up your knowledge. So I get where prior to having your licensing and having that qualified, maybe, you know, I'm a little on the fence there. But I think any learning that they're doing that beefs up their practical ability to do a better job as a professional. I mean, we're out there dealing with some professionals who haven't been under some very strict guidelines, and I get where you guys are coming from on getting down on the education and what people are learning, but those review courses, at least the ones that I've been party to or have taken myself, those are sometimes more in-depth and more intense than some of the CPE self-study courses that you guys allow now. So I guess that's where I'm coming from, is like, you can sometimes get better learning from something that's a review because it is focused. It's focused on a specific thing, and when somebody's going and having to take this to take an exam, number one, their focus is different. So I guess that's where I'm coming from, where you talk about type of learning and are we actually learning. That's better learning than somebody sitting in an 8-hour class. Believe me, I teach them. They're reading their newspapers and not paying attention to you. I see it all the time. And it is unfortunate. And there's nothing, I can't point them out in the class and say, hey, put your paper down. They're paying to be here. There's not really anything I can do about it. But you see it all the time. So I guess that's my perspective on some of that, of what type of learning are we really doing. And those review courses can offer actually a better level of education. To some extent, and I think it should count if you're doing that.
And Julie, I understand your point exactly. That was mm-hmm. my only apprehension in saying what I said, is they're getting the benefit of another certification, and for that, they're going to get all that CPE. On the other hand, I could do that right now. I could go in, as the rules are now, and take business management classes for 80 hours, and it would be all technical, and that's all I'd get. Or I could go and study only IFRS subjects, and there's enough breadth there that I could. But actually, if I was doing nothing but IFRS audits, or if I was only doing forensic work, that'd be appropriate. So I don't.
I get it. It was just a discussion point. I mean, I'm not rooted in this one at all, but.
Scotty, anything?
No, I guess one thought that passed in my mind, Julie, if your concern is, okay, they're taking the classes right now to be prepared to become, be a CFF or CFE or whatever it might be, and then they take a review class right before they take the exam within the same reporting period, kind of is there a double dipping at that point?
Or even is, if it's just as long right as it doesn't over the next reporting period, then.
Right, then that second piece goes with it. But
yeah. You've got 4 years then that you don't have to take anything else. Yeah. It's, you know, it's not a prevalent issue, but it was certainly worth the conversation. It's frustrating for us to see the people that take like one thing, and sometimes it'll really stretch. It's, you know, you're like, oh, okay. Hence the adding that it needs to be something technical in nature to qualify. Because mm-hmm. if you take one class at the university and you're getting 45 credits, literally more than half of what you have to report, and if it's not even, I mean, if it's marginally technical, it's like. And then these guys over here taking all this really good content, you know, you kind of go, oh, it's not really fair.
But they're gaming the system. It goes back to the standards that probably can't take on work that they're not suited for.
That's true.
And so there is a governor on this.
No, you're right.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that subject matter that they're taking at the university or college, it still has to fall within some of these. Right?
It didn't say that before. That's part of the language we just went over, was adding that it needs to be a technical subject. So 3D, it just said Right, because it really didn't say.
Well, let me go back, the opposite view of that. I mean, everybody should know that their full 80 hours are technical with the exception of the 16 non-technical they can take. But there's a limitation on non-technical. So that would put a kind of a gate there a little bit.
So let me give you an example.
Okay.
If you're a hospital administrator,
mm-hmm.
and you take courses that are relevant to your job and they're somewhat technical in nature but have nothing to do with you being a CPA, mm-hmm. does that enhance your proficiency as a CPA?
So there's
a line there, and it's sometimes kind of a gray area.
So when people would call, like they call me over the years, and I would tell them, you know, because, you know, the board doesn't pre-approve. Okay. However, you know, do you have a catalog in front of you or the website? Point them to these pages and then just work them down through section 40 or division 40, right? And here, you know, there's only 16-hour limitation on non-technical. Here's the golden rule, you know, working through. Here's examples of technical and non-technical. And, you know, I mean, once you walk people through, then it's like, okay, if you have further questions, you need to call the board at that point, Noella, right? And then Teresa. You know, but for the most part, I never had anybody say, I don't get it, right? Because they start going, oh, accounting, auditing, you know, I mean, like there's a lot of gates in here, if you really think about it. First of all, you're through that full 80 hours or the 16 non-technical, but, you know, if you start knowing, you know your stuff, you're going to see that you can't push over. So the example used to come up a lot of the time because there was someone that was down in South Coast area that did the tire changing thing. Right? Worked for a private company down there. And that was the example I used for years. That was not acceptable because it was not in the realm of, you know, accounting at all. No tax, no accounting, no auditing.
Well, I think this was one of the areas that Angie looked over, and because I'm not talking about C, but I'm talking about the adding technical. Mm-hmm. That you just, because we didn't specify technical subjects, that we kind of opened ourselves up there. So. Mm. So we were just closing a loop there, making sure that it's stating that even college courses have to mm-hmm. be in technical subjects yeah. when they're listed out in the law.
That seems reasonable.
Because there was a potential loophole that if somebody took
that we've
class,
been
that could count.
That we couldn't deny it based on, couldn't deny them their license renewal, right, based on, because there's a rule that was not necessarily clear.
I just took a bunch of scuba diving classes and now I can get my license.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, we're ready to move on.
So, I'm sorry to ask, what was our resolution here?
Little C?
Yes.
I think we're striking it completely.
Okay.
Review courses?
Well, we're striking the existing CPA exam
yeah.
as well?
Mm-hmm.
No, wait a minute.
I had to leave it as is.
I think leave it as is fine. If practically speaking, there are instances where this is an issue, I think the language as is fine.
Because it's specifically CPA exam.
Mm-hmm. So the CPA exam prep to get your license, that's still
no.
And that's what this is saying.
And that goes along with the
that
other
I agree
two
with.
Things in there that, you know.
Even if it's a college, even right. if it's a university class.
Leaving it makes it clear for people.
Yeah.
But review for other exams may count depending on the circumstances.
Yes.
We went through these. You know, NASPA reorganized their subject matter. Not recently, but a year and a half ago. And so we provided them with a spreadsheet of how all those crossovers would work. But on some of these, we found that what is being applied is not necessarily how it came out. So, for instance, NASBA puts one bucket as communications and marketing,
And we said, well, we have communications, which is technical, we have marketing, which is non-technical, and putting it all in one bucket is really confusing for our licensees because they see communications and marketing and communications as technical. So when you drill down and you look at what those CPE requirements are through NASBA and all the providers that are providing those services, it really is, communications is no longer what we were envisioning in our rules. It really is more of a non-technical. So that is available, and I think we included the backup for that in your packets, the CPE requirement, the guidelines, and the UAA stuff. So you can drill down and see what all is included in there, but that's where a lot of these changes came from. Same with business management organization. It became much more of an HR, you know, running your business course versus anything, you know, technical in nature.
And what about consulting? Because that can be extremely vague.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you could almost apply that to a lot of the non-technical subjects.
It's, that one's hard.
I know in the past we've had some concerns over the categorizations.
We've been trying to align ourselves more closely with NASBA too, and to be blunt, it's painful because, I mean, I can appreciate what you guys are, you know, placing down here because, you know, to that point, I looked at that and I was like, oh, business management and organization. Kind of like, okay, I mean, I know of someone that's a contract controller and what they do in that realm is not what somebody else would do for their clients, is not what somebody else would do for themselves as in managing their own practice. But on the other hand, you know, to that point, Michelle, where you mentioned consulting, I mean, at least that helps move back there, and then that person is also doing, you know, a lot of work around financial statements and that sort of thing. So I'm kind of coming to terms with it myself. I wouldn't say I agree with all of it, but we're trying to adjust to it. I mean, like, honestly, why do you need two ethics? Because, I mean, they break them out that way, but, you know, I would argue that they're professionals, so ethics is ethics, right? Then it just has to fall within how we specify. But
a lot of states only allow one or the other.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. I mean, that's where I might have a bit of disagreement with NASBA on it, but I think it does make it more clear. And where these things actually help, in my opinion, is that, and this is why we started adjusting, because people are licensed in various states, we're just trying to get to the point where it's more clean for folks, too. But,
okay. So, anything that gets you concerned or heartburn on the technical and non-technical subject?
Except, I mean, to your point, what is consulting? Like, how would you define consulting? Is it even worth having it in?
Yes.
It's in, yes.
Okay.
You'll be hearing about it otherwise.
So if there's a court, I mean, so these are categories that also, so if you get an independent study certificate from CERN, for example, and it says consulting on it, we're also looking at the title of that course because some of them are a little ambiguous. They can fall, that, which is how we're learning on. Do you know that, so under computer science, which we have as a technical category, there was an 18-hour course on how to run your iPhone. We saw three of those certificates come through and we're like, no. 18 hours on how to run your iPhone.
How to run
not
your iPhone?
Making you a better CPA. So these categories, you know, I mean, we don't just say, oh, it just says this, and we do look as much as possible.
I will say there are some of these where, you know, NASBA looks at it differently than we do, and when it comes to the things like, okay, taking an Excel class, where they would see that as non-technical.
That's technical.
I was going, I was looking at when I was looking through their standards. Yeah, I mean, they're kind of fussy about some things where I would disagree a little bit, that the better skills you can have around that, the better.
Right. And we do consider that technical. We still have computer science and technical. Well, we changed it. Information technology.
Under 0050, credit 11, evidence of completion, credit hours, we changed it from 25-minute period to just have a 15-minute period. So it covers the Mano, it covers the 0.5s.
When I read this, I read it as that was the only, that you could only get it. I kind of made notes that does this need to be expanded a little bit to encompass?
It's just saying that it's measured by 50-minute hours. So yeah. The half hour is measured at 25, the nano is at 0.2. Everything's based on a 50-minute hour.
I do. I mean, I'm being respectful when I say this. I do understand what you're saying, but that's not the way I read it at all, because, man, maybe this is because I looked at it from that traditional 1 hour equals 50 minutes, but when I look at, I do remember a time where there was an issue where each section of a conference was not 50 minutes, so it wasn't counting, and it was like, it goes way back. So it's like, no, you divide, you add it all up, you divide by 50. If there's a fraction at that point in time, you have to round back. But maybe we need to keep this, but also clarify someplace where people know that a nano at 10 minutes equals a 0.2.
Well, there is. It's down further on that page and onto the next page.
Okay, sorry. I'm just a little worried about when those of us here are not in the room at some point, how others would look at that.
But it is. It's down there. We're just not to it yet. It's under nano learning. The top of the next page. Nano learning credits are provided in 0.2 CPE hour increments. And then in the previous nano learning section, it talked about 10-minute sessions.
Yeah, I was just thinking about where people hone in on one section.
Did you want to put like a table there?
I don't know that we... Really,
well, we
can do that in our rules.
But we can.
Oh, yeah, put a table in.
Because
you're speaking in generalities, right? So, like, there are courses, that are going to be an hour and 20 minutes long. So, what does that mean?
Like, it's one point. It's
yeah,
going to be
so
one point.
Would a sentence like, that's one sentence at the end of it, after this sentence, to say, you know, time in excess or below 50 minutes or allocable on a prorated basis or something like that, just to make it clear, sufficiently clear.
Yeah, I'm just worried that it looks like there's, only one, credit can be only in the range of one 50-minute segment.
Mm-hmm. You could say any acceptable fraction thereof, and maybe a C below or...
That would, something like that would be good.
Not to be less than 1/10 increments.
Yeah.
So these 6 million pounds.
So do lawyers.
We will do our best to clarify that. Going down to individual study programs. Individual study programs are eligible for CPE credit only if the program is offered by a NASA CPE registry approved sponsor. It used to be that you could have a registered sponsor, but not every single course the sponsor provided was approved, which is insanely hard to track. So they're not doing that anymore. So we just struck that piece of the actual programs being approved. Nano learning, this is some of the same language we read already, just in a different spot, because this is credit 11 and certification for nano learning. Those are some of the same pieces. And then that's sharing where it shows that it's a 0.2.
Oh, yes, thank you.
The next section is lecture, discussion leader, or speaker, and how they earn their credits. We made no changes, but if you have any concerns with that, let us know. published articles. Again, we did not change anything in that section.
Is this in another section, the published article, something about first date or something?
It is in the what's allowed, types of CPE allowed section.
So this defines what it takes for a published article
to
be
qualified as a published article? Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a risk somebody would only look at this and...
Programs.
Well, I mean, it's been in there for a bazillion years, and we don't get a lot of calls on this. So. There are certain sections where people really hone in, but...
Yeah.
And there is a chance that we could do, you know, organize things a little bit differently, but that's a whole, you know, very huge process.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. And just walking through over time, walking people through that Division 40, this was really clear to people. They would just go, oh, okay. So, that's nice.
And that's good, so that hopefully that will stick.
So just kind of moving through each piece.
And then university and college credits, again, we just added that it has to be from a regionally accredited college or university.
Which is in line with what we accept for qualification for the exam.
Okay, page 10. New licensees, and then we added reinstated licensees. This, we prorate our CPE requirements depending on what month and year the licensee was first licensed. And then we got to thinking that, you know, reinstatement can come at any point in the year too. And so, to be fair, we are considering an amendment to allow reinstatement applications to operate. And I think we've done that in the past. This has been our process, but we haven't.
This was adding the bit about non-technical, because right now the rule just says that non-technical is limited to 16 hours. But if you say that you were licensed in April and you only owe 10 hours, or I guess however many hours that would be, I need my little math
yes,
chart.
Yes, but we did. We got somebody that had all non-technical for their CPE. That's what it is.
And the rules allow it.
Yeah.
So
makes sense.
This is a good clarification.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nothing new on waivers. Failure to comply.
Now this is the stuff we've tabled, right?
No, this is just CPE penalties. So before it just said 16-hour CPE penalty, and it only addressed active licensees. But inactive licensees have an 8-hour CPE penalty. It's not 16 hours, so we broke it out just to make it clear.
Oh, okay. But isn't this what we're addressing, is what the penalty should be if you go from one...
That was muni that we were talking
that was
about. This
no,
is
no last meeting.
I'm talking last meeting. Isn't that the whole thing we're coming back to? Because if you have a lapse status or an inactive status to renew, there was a loophole that if you went from one to the other, you didn't. Isn't that part of this?
This is... I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think this the penalty still applies unless you meet that other... caveat, right, that we're writing language for.
Right. Would that change this number of penalty? I guess is what I can't remember. So I'm asking.
There may potentially have to be other language, but once Angie writes that language, then I'm confident that she will make sure that all the other places are that it touches will be updated.
Okay.
Right now, this is consistent with what's in there. The new language changes, we'll, I get what you're saying.
Okay.
I just kind of compliment you because
these meetings are so much more productive and expedient and efficient than the first round of LRC because of all preparation. This is really good.
Is there something else in the meetings? Okay. So, like I said earlier, we will probably send out another doodle. And I think we were doing, oh my gosh,
several
almost
of those are doing right now.
Almost every other conference, right? Probably end of June, first part of July, since we're almost at June now.
July is going to be tough for me.
Okay.
At least the first 3 weeks.
Okay. Does the end of June look better?
If we do it, if you're looking at the end of June, at least for me, I mean, I can't dictate what everybody else is doing. But
June works for me.
Okay. Division 30 is going to be a big one, and I don't know that that group is going to take a lot of help with our council, and so I can't promise that we would have that done in, say, 3 weeks, which is what it would have to be at this point in order to get it out to you. So our next board meeting is August 23rd. 22nd. Oh, we just changed it, yeah. So if we could even do late July or early August, that could work.
Yeah, late July works for me. It's just those first 3 weeks of July.
I mean, it doesn't have to go to the board, really, unless we're totally finished with them. But we still have these two to go through and then go through another 5 days.
Well, would you anticipate we'd probably deal with it in October work session? Mm-hmm. Probably all the language changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, let's think about end of July, first part of August, if that works for everyone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you all have your calendars today, or do you like the doodle?
I like the doodle. Because most of the time, if we just bring up a conflict, mm-hmm. that I might be able to move, so the doodle allows me to see if I can move something.
Okay.
There's more flexibility.
Are you going? I like doodles. It's a love-hate thing.
And at that meeting, are we going to go back to what we did?
What I'm thinking is that we'll do 30 and 50. Those are a couple of biggies. So 30 is all your code of professional conduct, your disciplinary, all of that stuff. Division 50 is peer review. I think there's a few changes, but nothing major, major, major. So we can do just two divisions again and then have another meeting and go through all of the table stuff and some revised language, or we could propose some of our language that we've left in division 10 and maybe 5 or some others to flush through that. I mean, we can give you all and see what we get through. That's fine with me.
But up to you guys.
Let's see how busy 30 and 50 are. I'll make a choice on that because I don't want to have, you know.
It might be helpful if we have, you know, if we take all the divisions and we sit down with Angie and go through and try and develop, like, then to go back and look at all those language changes might be, like, there's some continuity there, since
right.
some of them kind of touch throughout.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and especially with some of the, yeah. Okay, then we have a plan of action. Nicely done, Chair?
Yeah.
Good job.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're done.
John shared the first couple of years worth.